This episode of The Sweaty Penguin is brought to you by cigarettes. Do you think cigars are overcompensating? Try cigarettes today.
Off the coast of Norway, the world's largest floating wind farm became fully operational about a month ago, which, no, is not where baby kites are raised. The wind turbines are actually being used by a petroleum company called Equinor to power drilling operations in the North Sea. I'm not saying by any means that this is an ideal scenario, but as Lil B would say, let him cook. Let them put their little Remy the Rat in their hats and try out some new techniques. Let the food critics decide. Good Wednesday morning. I'm Ethan Brown, and this is Tip of the Iceberg, where I will break down some environmental news and then answer a question from our listeners on the air. Submit questions via Patreon, email, or social media. Patron questions go to the front of the line, so sign up at patreon.com/thesweatypenguin. On September 20th to 22nd, I had the pleasure of attending the Climate Changes Everything Conference in New York City, put on by Covering Climate Now, the Columbia Journalism Review, The Guardian, The Nation, and Solutions Journalism Network. And by the way, thank you to Solutions Journalism Network for enabling us to attend. I actually got to meet Hallie in person for the first time, and she's been on our team almost 2 years, so that was amazing. Turns out we're the exact same height, which no one had that on their bingo card. Our comedy producer Mo wasn't able to attend, but wanted me to let you know anytime she'd turn off her rental car and the display screen read climate off, she was thinking of us. We also may have made headway on our funding situation, and with no crime, too, so I hope to have good news for you soon. One more step toward a leaked photo of me holding a stack of $100 bills to my ear captioned, "When money calls, I answer." The conference was part of New York City's Climate Week, and it was a gathering of climate journalists looking at how to cover climate change better, with a significant emphasis on incorporating solutions. We cover solutions a lot on The Sweaty Penguin, but not quite as often as we'd like on Tip of the Iceberg, so I wanted to take a look at this wind farm story and think about it in the larger context of climate solutions. Inaugurated last month by Crown Prince Haakon of Norway, Hywind Tampen is the world's largest floating offshore wind farm and the world's most boring beach vacation resort. The mini golf course is still in the works. Situated about 140 kilometers off the Norwegian coast, in waters 260 to 300 meters deep, the wind farm consists of 11 turbines. These turbines began generating power in November of 2022 and reached full operation recently. Unlike traditional offshore wind turbines that are fixed to the seabed, the turbines at Hywind Tampen are mounted on floating concrete structures, allowing them to be placed in much deeper waters and go free range, which is far better for their health in the long run. This design allows floating turbines to be installed in locations beyond the reach of fixed bottom turbines. The project is led by the fossil fuel company Equinor in collaboration with partners like Vår Energi, Inpex Idemitsu, Petoro, Wintershall Dea, and OMV. As I mentioned in the intro, Hywind Tampen will be powering Equinor's North Sea oil and gas field operations, aiming to reduce their carbon dioxide emissions. With a system capacity of 88 megawatts, the wind farm is projected to supply about 35% of the annual electricity needs of its five platforms. And obviously, from a climate perspective, that's a pretty big red flag. Not as big as the one my ex-girlfriend was waving when I found out she'd gotten matching rings with her, quote, work hubby, but it's up there. Even if the wind farm itself isn't emitting carbon, it's helping enable a project that is. My other concern is related to public relations. A few years ago, Equinor set a goal to achieve carbon-neutral global operations by 2030. That's great, don't get me wrong. I hope they hit it, and do not quit it. But global operations does not include carbon emissions later in the supply chain from the oil or the gas that they sell. It just refers to the emissions that are coming directly from activities that Equinor does, such as drilling, refining, and when Linda puts a frozen lasagna in the shared microwave for 22 minutes. Linda, the inside is frozen forever. Just let Bill heat up his hot pocket. But for an energy company, the fossil fuels you sell are the largest source of carbon emissions, generally speaking. And several fossil fuel companies have set these carbon-neutral global operations goals, well aware of that. To their credit, Equinor does have a goal of becoming completely carbon-neutral, including the energy they sell, by 2050. And that's the important one. That's where they can use the term carbon-neutral and not be misleading. But by powering new oil and gas operations in the North Sea, this wind farm is pushing the business toward the, quote, carbon-neutral operations goal and away from the completely carbon-neutral goal. If Equinor starts claiming to the public that their North Sea drilling operations are carbon neutral, even if it's technically true, most people may not understand that nuance, and I worry a bit about what that could mean down the line. All that said, I think it's tempting for climate advocates to overstate the downside of this wind farm. Wind farm or not, Equinor was going to pursue these oil and gas operations. Is it better that they reduce their carbon emissions in the process? Absolutely, no question. Is there a risk that publicizing the wind farm will lead to greenwashing? Sure, but it can also lead to some good things. First, it can signal leadership to others in the fossil fuel industry. If they see competitors pursue clean energy, they may follow so they don't get left behind, and that's called influencing. Take note, social media teams. It's a lot easier to address climate change when fossil fuel companies are enthusiastic about clean energy and trying to get involved themselves. And second, publicizing a fossil fuel company building a wind farm might be one of the clearest signs to the world that wind energy is simply preferable to fossil fuels. It would be like Disney pulling up Netflix for company movie night, or Google employees using Bing as their default search engine. It's one thing to get high off your own supply, but when someone is getting high off their competitor's supply, it should be a really strong indicator for us that that technology or product is really, really good. Be it for its environmental advantages or simply its cheaper cost, it appears wind energy has crossed that threshold. And all that goes to a bigger point. No solution is a perfect solution. Obviously, some are better than others. A wind farm powering a shelter for adorable kittens is better than a wind farm powering a clandestine clown convention. But there aren't any silver bullets in the climate space. For journalists like myself, that means we have to cover the limitations of each solution and where it can improve. But it also means we shouldn't suck the excitement out of every single thing just because it isn't perfect or it doesn't do everything. I've been reflecting on a particular exchange at the conference, and the conference was live broadcast, so I feel comfortable sharing this. We're during the Q&A with the White House National Climate Advisor, Ali Zaidi. He received the question of why the president has not declared a national climate emergency. I see this discussed a lot in the climate world. And what he explained, which is 100% correct, at least as far as I understand this stuff, is that as president, you can't just declare an emergency and expect something to happen. It's kind of like Michael Scott declaring bankruptcy. No, it's exactly like Michael Scott declaring bankruptcy. Remember, Congress makes the laws, the president enforces the laws, and the courts interpret the laws. And me? I'm just a silly weather boy in a penguin onesie. As such, the president can't just do whatever he wants. He can declare an emergency under the National Emergencies Act, but there are 148 different emergency powers spread across dozens of other laws that he can invoke in different scenarios. My personal favorite is the "we're running low on avocados" state of emergency. Some have suggested that the Defense Production Act, Stafford Act, or National Emergencies Act itself could allow the president to unilaterally end oil exports, suspend offshore leases, cut fossil fuel investments abroad, ramp up clean tech manufacturing, and build renewable energy systems in vulnerable communities. But we don't actually know that he can do that. That's not what those laws were designed to do by any means. And if the president does something that he doesn't have the power to do, not only would it give girls on TikTok the ick, but it would also immediately get blocked by a court, so it won't happen, and then it can lead to a court case that results in the president's powers being narrowed. And even if that doesn't happen and your plan does work, a future president can just repeal whatever you did if they don't like it. Now, the president has used executive authorities to address climate change that did not involve declaring a national emergency. We've done episodes on how the president has ramped up mineral production under the Defense Production Act, banned Arctic offshore oil and gas leasing under the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act, and created new tailpipe and power plant carbon emission standards under the Clean Air Act. I'm not going to argue if these are good ideas or bad ideas, I'm just telling you what happened. He hasn't needed to declare an emergency to do some stuff he wanted to do. But what's a lot more durable, as Ali Zaidi put it, is actually getting stuff done in Congress. Again, Congress makes the laws. That is the job of every congressperson, no matter how much the variety of gossiping and personal attacks are giving unemployed. They can do whatever they want within the confines of the Constitution. And they have, addressing climate through the Inflation Reduction Act, the bipartisan infrastructure bills, and others. Again, not saying if they're good or bad, just saying what's happened. So it made sense to me when Ali Zaidi explained that the president would prefer to tackle climate that way than by declaring an emergency, setting off a bunch of court cases, and possibly coming out further behind than when he started. In all fairness, I may have explained that a little differently than Ali Zaidi did, but it seemed like I was the only one at the conference satisfied with that answer. It seemed like other journalists felt he was dodging the question or something. And look, you're free to believe that the president should throw everything at the wall and see what sticks, whether it's executive orders, a nondescript climate emergency, or a fistful of cooked spaghetti. That's totally understandable. But we have to start with the same baseline understanding of civics. Sort of like a wind farm powering oil and gas operations, we shouldn't just knock all baby steps in climate policy because they don't tackle everything and they don't have the word emergency in them. No policy can tackle everything, and certainly no executive action can come close to tackling everything. That's not to say climate policies don't deserve criticism. They all have flaws, and we've talked about many of them. But as much as we as journalists cover limitations of these policies, we should also be covering when there are reasons for those limitations, that constitutional separation of powers and checks and balances mean not everything can get done in one fell swoop, especially by the executive branch. If headlines were to say, the president failed to declare a climate emergency without explaining all that, it would be extremely misleading. Our goal at the Sweaty Penguin is to make climate change less overwhelming, less politicized, and more fun. We do that in part through comedy, in part through throwing raging house parties where everyone goes home with an eco-friendly light bulb, but in much bigger part through solutions journalism, which is why I'm so glad we had the opportunity to be one of the Solutions Journalism Network's 9 Climate Beacon newsrooms for the last 9 months. Doing solutions journalism isn't just sharing good news, it's investigating the limitations, but in a constructive way that shows a path forward, not a no solution will ever be good enough because it's not 100% perfect way. Journalism should not take away from the collective hope that society can improve. And so as much as it's important for us to dig into the drawbacks of climate policies or fossil fuel company wind farms, it's okay to come away with the Lil B style sentiment, "Let him cook." And now, here's Emma with the news.
Hey, I'm Emma, and this is your weekly update. NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information reported on August 14th it is, quote, virtually certain that 2023 will be one of the top five warmest years on record. There's a 50% chance it will be the warmest year ever recorded, and there's a 99% chance that we will never stop mentioning it. And neither will you when you run out of small talk. Yellowknife, the capital of Canada's Northwest Territories, not to be confused with what your nephew calls a banana, began a large-scale evacuation on August 17th due to a major wildfire approaching the city. The fire, located about 9 miles from the city, is part of Canada's worst wildfire season on record because, in case you already forgot, there's a chance that 2023 might be the warmest year on record. While the government provided essentials such as free gasoline and food, they sadly forgot the need for Taylor Swift tickets. The decision to evacuate was met with shock and disbelief by residents, even though wildfires are not uncommon in the area. Authorities have also warned against seeking refuge on nearby islands due to deteriorating air quality, even though that sounds like a fun DIY fire fest. In news that any toddler would be excited about, the Schmidt Ocean Institute released new findings uncovering a whole new ecosystem of worms, snails, and bacteria living beneath the seafloor under undersea volcanic vents on the East Pacific Rise. It's kind of like when you find bugs you've never seen before eating the crumbs under your bed, but less overly personal. In experiments using a robot, scientists found that certain animals emerge from these sub-seafloor cavities, mostly the attention-seeking ones. But this adds to a series of recent deep-sea discoveries showcasing the diverse and lesser-known marine life. Like your mom. And highlights the vast unexplored expanse of ocean humans have yet to uncover. Maybe we'll find the Meg after all. Thankfully, Jason Statham has been preparing for this his whole life. Or at least the last 5 years. Typhoon Sayola hit China with heavy rains and overflows in late August, leading to the escape of 70 crocodiles from a farm in the city of Maoming, Guangdong Province. But let's be real, that was probably their plan all along. Local authorities are working to apprehend the on-the-run fugitive reptiles, with the Baja men pledging the profits from their poorly timed remix release, Who Let the Crocs Out? All I have to say is, if Steve Irwin, the OG croc cop, were still here, he would have had this handled already. Rest in peace, Steve. I still think about you every day, brother.
Do you wish you could savor the tangy taste of tar in your everyday life? Then cigarettes are for you. With cigarettes, you'll get all the benefits of looking like a cool indie middle schooler, on top of the social clout that comes with smelling like a wood factory smokestack. But wait, there's more. Smoke enough cigarettes in a row and you'll get nicotine poisoning. Free vomit! Cigarettes. You're too cool for health warnings.
Welcome back to Tip of the Iceberg. It's time for Ask Me Anything, where our listeners get a chance to ask me any environmental questions they may have. Submit questions via Patreon, email, or social media. Patron questions go to the front of the line, so sign up at patreon.com/thesweatypenguin. We have a special treat today. We have a listener caller, Blair, on the line. Blair, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. So you have a question for us?
Yeah, you know, with this whole Hawaii wildfire thing, I'm just like, there's so much news about it and just so much going on. And it's just so devastating. I see like the pictures of people running into the water and I can't fathom like this whole thing. Like, is it just they see it coming and they run into the water? Is an alarm sound? Like, take me, like, what are these people dealing with when that happens?
Yeah, it's really hard to wrap our head around, obviously.
Yeah.
I think, as I understand it, there actually is an alarm system that was supposed to function on the island that did not function properly.
Oh my
and
God.
That was part of the issue, and in part because a big part of what fueled the fire was winds from Hurricane Dora, which was about 500 miles south in the Pacific Ocean and later turned into Typhoon Dora. It became one of the longest, or I believe it was one of the only tropical cyclones to go all the way from the Eastern Pacific to the Western Pacific and turn from a hurricane into a typhoon. So the winds that were 500 miles away, but part of this weather system, had actually, in addition to creating more ability for the wildfire to spread, it would have likely affected power lines and electricity and that sort of thing, which may have affected the alert system. Wow. I can't get into the head of anyone on the island running into the ocean. I'm as hopeless to that as anyone, but it is certainly really scary. And if I can offer one small kernel of hope, I know that Maui does plan for this kind of thing. Maui has had many fires in its history, but we can always do so much more to prepare, to study how these things can happen and can get worse in a changing climate. And I hope that we can take more steps in that direction.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it just makes me think, like, does my town have something like that? I don't even think so. So that's just kind of where my head goes, is it's like, if they don't have it, I mean, does my small town have that? Because I don't think they have a budget for an alarming system. Or like you said, if power goes out or something, I didn't even think about that. Of course. Yeah. I mean, that would make it so you can't ring the alarms. And so there's just got to be a better way, right?
Yeah, exactly. It similarly, like, I think cell service went down, so people weren't receiving emergency texts. So right. A whole mess of combining forces there. And it really speaks to the fact that one of the big concerns about climate change, like what we hear all the time, is the 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming, and it's such an abstract thing, but really the concrete thing we see is not just more extreme weather events, but we see extreme weather compounding on itself. So it's not just a hurricane or just a wildfire, it's the two things happening at the same time. And that ultimately creates problems like this, where hurricanes are knocking people off the grid at the same time as they need emergency information about this fire. That's one example of many where we see it's called correlated extreme weather events. And again, we need to understand that these weird combinations are increasingly possibilities, and hopefully we can take action in that regard.
And can you explain then, like, what is the difference between weather and climate? Is there a difference? Is it the same thing?
Yeah, so weather refers to day-to-day trends. So within an hour or a day or maybe a week, whatever the temperature and precipitation and humidity and all that looks like. Climate refers to long-term trends. So a year, 5 years, 10 years, 100 years. What does a given region look like in regard to temperature and precipitation? So when we talk about climate changing, we're not talking about every day getting slightly hotter. We're talking about way hotter hot days, way colder cold days, way more intense hurricanes and wildfires and droughts, and all of these things put together shift the average by what seemingly is a little bit, but it's not that every day just gets a degree hotter. It's a lot of things that average together create create that shift.
And kind of my other question kind of goes into what you're talking about is like, we're concerned about like it changing a degree or two for the average global temperature. And to me, okay, like 1 or 2 degrees, that doesn't sound like a lot. Then people freak out that it is changing by just a degree or two. And can you explain like, why is that? So if the average global change is just a degree or two, why is that such a big deal?
Yeah. So again, it goes back to the fact that small change is what drives these much more extreme weather events. So we're not seeing every day get just slightly warmer. We're seeing a lot of days get colder, but a lot of days get way, way, way warmer. And when we put that together, that creates cause for concern. Also, it, of course, drives issues such as sea level rise and so many different things. And we can go through our whole podcast library for people to learn about that. But there's many issues that it causes that are much more tangible than just a shift on a line graph.
So like, is there anything that I can do as a sole individual to help this cause, or is it a lost cause for just me to do anything?
Yeah, on climate change, there's a lot, and I've talked about it before. I think individual actions, they won't fix everything, but they can often inspire community level change if people see someone else doing good things, and it can spark conversations and lead to more interest.
Right.
I think it's important to use your voice. For myself, I am not someone who would have ever been good at activism. I can't put my nuanced thoughts onto a sign, and I hate crowds and loud noises, but
yeah.
writing and podcasting and all of this worked for me. And there's many different avenues people can take. And I always advocate, especially trying to talk to more people you disagree with is really helpful. It can give you new perspectives and it can help push this conversation forward. On wildfires specifically, though, it's important to, I've been trying to kind of hammer this point over the last few months, that we talk a lot about how devastating and sad these are, and that is important. We also need to talk about the fact that there are solutions to wildfires. 85% of wildland fires in the U.S. are caused by human negligence. So unattended campfires, out of control gender reveal parties, all that stuff. It's really the norm, not the anomaly.
Those
and so
stupid lanterns that people light and throw them up in the air. I hate
those things. Exactly. So if we can understand that, that's a obvious individual action to take. Just don't throw your cigarette in a forest. But beyond that, there's a lot that we can do with regard to managing our forests, clearing out brush, doing logging as needed, controlled burns, all these different strategies that can help prevent wildfires. And even though climate change will make wildfires worse, we can also take steps to make them not quite as bad.
Got it. Yeah.
Thanks so much for those questions. I really appreciate it.
No, I love the podcast. Thanks for having me. This was exciting for me.
That does it for this week's episode of Tip of the Iceberg. Take 2 minutes, help out the show, and get a shout out at the end of the show by leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple or Podcast Addict, or join our Patreon at patreon.com/thesweatypenguin. There you get merch, bonus content, and your questions move to the front of the line for Tip of the Iceberg. Special thanks to our Emperor Penguin patrons, Lawrence Harris and Brownie Central. Thank you all for listening, and I'll see you on Friday for a deep dive on rice. Thank you.